For those of you just tuning in, you are listening to Art World Innovators on UMFM 101.5. Our guest this evening is Gordon Skalberg, Swedish photographer, artist, and graphic designer who began his career in the family business, Skaltech. After 22 years at Skaltech, designing all the company brochures, photographing industrial machinery, designing trade show displays, and traveling across the world, connecting with many cultures and people, Gordon took this experience and moved into a full-time art practice. He published a book of his photographs, began painting, studying art history, and took a short course at the art school on the Swedish West Coast. Gordon has had his work in a number of exhibitions, studio tours, art galleries, and juried group shows in Sweden, and art shows in Santa Fe, New Mexico. His work may be found in collections at various corporate art clubs and Uppsala University Art Collection in Sweden. Welcome to Art World Innovators, and thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Born into the second generation of an entrepreneurial family, you followed your artistic passion in a corporate capacity in your family business, Skaltech. Can you describe a few examples of how you applied your photography and artistic vision in corporate designs or projects?
We had an art director who helped my father in the 70s to shape the company profile and so on. And he became like a mentor to me, even after he passed away much too early. And I just became interested, since I had started taking photographs early on already as a teenager, I got an opportunity to help out with those things when we had to photograph our machines. And eventually I started designing our trade shows and our brochures. And eventually I learned to do desktop publishing when the digital programs came. And I'm really self-taught, but I was able to watch professionals and was able to learn a lot when I had a purpose to really do it. And so I was involved in a lot of that in the company. It was a great thing. And that's when I was probably the most happy.
And was there a turning point that led you from the corporate world into full-time art practice?
I think it was a transition that probably took at least 10 years. And it's also, I mean, my dad is a fantastic entrepreneur and inventor. I was pretty much living his dream and not really listening to my own feelings. And I remember one day when it became clear to me, what am I going to do when I grow up or when I retire? So I needed to figure out what I really wanted to do. And it was a really hard transition to take. I've had a lot of people comment on that over the years, that they say that they could see that I did the right thing. And it's very nice that even my dad is one of my biggest fans today, even though it kind of broke his heart by leaving.
Your Facing Plywood series 1, 2, and 3 reveals your intimate studies and unique, captivating style of painting people, their details, their eyes and expressions, close-ups that seem to take us through the windows of their souls. What intrigues you most as you compose your paintings of people?
I don't really know what led me to do that when I started out. In the beginning, I wanted to paint, but I had no idea what to paint. So to find out what to do and how to express yourself is a hard journey to start on. And I was lucky to find both my material, the plywood, and also my interest in people and faces. And I don't consider them portraits, but eventually people asked me, what are you trying to say? I didn't know. Somebody challenged me and said, you need to figure it out and you need to tell me. And that's when I realized that the pupil in the eye became like a black hole in space. We're taking in information all the time and storing it in our minds, and it's happening continuously and it's all stored in there. And we can change dramatically if something special happens, if there's a catastrophe or we meet someone who is really, really fascinating or whatever. So when I started thinking about this, I realized that my wife that I have known since the early 80s, I don't really know her. I don't really know her inner feelings and thoughts right now. So how can I judge? And that became really interesting to me.
Are the elements of line and light important in your compositions? And what have you discovered as you've experimented with their effects?
Or to say, obviously light is super important. When I do faces, I like there to be a dark side and a bright side, which I think is also our experiences as human beings. We go through, people are looking for happiness. My thought is that happiness is something that can be a moment, fleeting moment. It's like when you see the geese flying overhead on their way north or south. You have to grasp that moment of euphoria or happiness, and then you have to live even when the times are dark and harder. And I think if there is darkness, we will appreciate the light more. And I find that very interesting when I paint.
Also, growing up in Sweden, did the native culture and landscapes inspire your artworks?
I'm not really sure it did so much in the beginning, and I think to work with the culture, it's sometimes hard to realize your own culture. Coming here to Santa Fe and also being exposed to the native culture, I almost was envious for a while. But then I started thinking about my own roots and even the old Viking art, which is absolutely fascinating. I don't think I really thought so much about that. I didn't consider myself a landscape painter in the beginning, but I've been doing more and more landscapes, and obviously I have been doing some coastal landscapes around the area where we live in Sweden. So now it's probably influencing me more than before.
Early this fall, you had an exciting exhibit facing plywood with the Kulturhotellet in Helsingborg. Can you tell us about this event and describe a few of your favorite works from this exhibit?
Well, it's not really a gallery, so it's more like a culture space where they even have concerts, classic music, and so on. And they wanted me to show, and they gave me basically total freedom to curate my own exhibition. And it became almost like a retrospective. I had some pretty old works, over 10 years, which is old for me, and some brand new. And the interesting thing is that the newest works were my, what I call horizon pieces, which are very, very minimalistic. It's more or less blue and a line. And in some of them, there is like a landmass that you can see, but they're very, very minimalistic. And interestingly enough, that is what attracted Artwork International to my art. So you never know what you do and what it can lead to.
You were also involved in the art studio tours in Sweden. Can you tell us a little bit about them?
The studio tour is a very interesting thing. We're about 140 artists in this part of southwestern Sweden who are opening up their homes or studios during Easter when people are off, but the weather is normally not good enough to be doing things outside, so people have time, and they get in their cars, and they start driving around, and it's small kids, and it's grandma and grandpa, and so on. And I think a lot of times it's people who are not really going to see a lot of art the rest of the year, so it's a very educational thing. And since it's in our homes, we can pretty much show a full range of what we have, and I try to circulate my work and always try to have something new. And it's a really fascinating experience because people get to see the studios, they get to meet the artists, and they get to ask questions. We've had up to 3,500 people basically during 4 days, which is like an invasion, and it's amazing to see so many happy and inspired people. It's really fun. I pretty much show a whole range of my work, from the latest to some pretty old stuff.
From your earlier training in mechanical engineering and the years of working in the family business, how did that enrich your working technique with steel and creating some of the larger scale installations that you show, such as Victory?
I don't think that they are really a result of my technical background so much. People sometimes ask me how I come up with the ideas for my art and my creativity, and I say that it's like hiking. You hike and then you see that, oh, I want to go up and see what's behind that hill over there, and you go. So it's like if you constantly move, you will find things, and that's how those pieces evolved. So now in retrospect, it's like, yeah, it's kind of fun that they tie in with my technical background, but that's not really how they came about. And I don't even know exactly how I came up with it, but it's fun to have that feel part of my art that connects with my past.
Well, some of them are really big. Do you have them installed in other places?
The big ones, I have only made two. One is installed outside our house, my studio in Sweden. I was going to sell it to the county, was very interested in having one. The problem was where to place it, because it needs to be in a place where there is open, relatively neutral background. Or like my brother bought one piece and had it shipped over to his house outside of Phoenix, Arizona, and he just placed it right in front of his house wall, which is really, really cool. And I want to do more of those large pieces. It's almost like I need to do them on commission to know that they will be placed in an area or a place where they will really work. But they're really, really nice, and they live with the landscape and the weather. It's fascinating.
Do you have any sculpture parks nearby that you might be able to approach for something like that?
Maybe, but the sculpture park might be too cluttered in a way. So I've been thinking about doing a mock-up of plywood and taking it out in the desert and just photograph it. Or maybe just put it out sort of like a street art project, but a desert art project. That's one thing that I've been toying with.
And has Artwork International Incorporated been instrumental in introducing you to the art world? And can you elaborate?
It's pretty early. We started working late in 2019, and they found me. I didn't even know they existed. I'm very excited about starting up this cooperation. It's already showing results. For me, it's hard to believe in myself almost, because it's almost like I consider myself an outsider since I came from a totally different background and pretty much self-taught. So it's hard to know what my own potential, but they are really excited about working with me. So that gives me a boost of confidence. It's going to be really exciting to see what we can do together.
And what advice would you give artists who start mid-career to work exclusively on their art practice?
That's a really hard question. I don't like to give advice too much. People have asked me if they can come and learn from me, and I said I can't teach anything because I was never really taught, so I had to experiment and find my own way. And I mean, a lot of people have been inspired by my change in life, but I keep telling people that don't do it unless you really have to. I mean, if you're basically happy where you are, don't change it, because it's hard. It's a transition that is painful. In my case, I was extremely fortunate that I had financial freedom to do it based on my family business background. So for me, it was in one way easier to do that, even though it was extremely hard to leave the business, the expectations, the responsibilities, and so on. Of course, you have to find out how to make a living and put food on your table, but follow your heart. I know from my experience that making the decision was the hard part. Once I had made it, it was surprisingly liberating and fascinating to move on. And then after that, it's not been easy, but it's what I'm passionate about. And so if you find your passion, go for it.
Have you any exhibits or projects coming up that you'd like to share with our audience?
Well, my studio tour in Sweden is coming up, and since I have so many people coming, I feel like they're expecting me to be there. So that's the main thing that I work toward all winter. And then the Kulturhotellet, people are telling me, I haven't heard anything concrete, but they're telling me that they want me to do a large mural in Helsingborg this summer. And I'm pretty excited about that, because street art to me is a fascinating art form, because people are not going to a gallery to see it. They might drive by, and if they see it, you have really been able to touch someone. So that's pretty cool.
Well, I'd like to thank you so much for speaking with us and sharing your story and valuable insight with our audience. It's been a pleasure speaking with you, and we wish you continued success.
Thank you.
Thank you. That was Gordon Skalberg, Swedish artist and photographer, speaking with us from Santa Fe, New Mexico. For those of you just tuning in, you are listening to Art World Innovators on UMFM 101.5. Our guest this evening is Robert Eastwood, senior advisor to the firm Number 10 Architectural Group, a company that successfully delivers innovative solutions supported by a fundamental understanding of processes, construction technology, and long-term building performance for institutional, commercial, hospitality, education, and recreation designs. Number 10 Architectural Group began in the 1950s and has been behind the development of a number of Winnipeg's most prominent buildings. Robert has been a partner with Number 10 for over 30 years before his transition to senior advisor, and has been involved in a number of major projects, including a university campus in Zambia while he was still a student, Oak Hammock Marsh, the original Winnipeg Convention Center, and its redevelopment as the RBC Convention Center, and the MTS Center, with a variety of innovative, enduring projects still considered to be some of the best ever produced by the firm. Number 10 has earned numerous awards and is highly recognized as a leading architectural firm in the industry. Welcome to Art World Innovators, and thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, you're very welcome.
You started out with Number 10 Architectural Group as a student, a firm that highly values sharing its philosophy and practices through mentorships. Can you tell us about your experience as you began your career with Number 10?
Well, it was interesting. When I started as a student, I had some interesting history relative to Number 10, because my original interest in building goes back to a building that Number 10 did in the early 1960s, which I watched go up as a young kid and decided I really wanted to go into architecture, and ultimately went into architecture. And the first firm that I interviewed relative to a project was Number 10 Architectural Group. So I was lucky enough to get in there as a student in the mid-1970s and to work on a range of projects, one of which was one you mentioned, the university in Zambia, and to work with a very experienced group of obviously partners and project architects and designers in a very team-like collaborative setting. And that really set the roots for my relationship with Number 10.
The original founding members of the architectural group that grew Number 10 had interesting backgrounds and were involved in a number of significant projects of striking modernist designs. Can you tell us about the history of the firm through the partners and maybe the vision behind some of their major projects?
Well, what I know of it in talking over the years with some of the founding partners like Morley Blankstein, Izzy Koop, Alan Hanna, the firm grew out of actually two practices who were developing and prominent in the 1950s. One was the Waisman-Ross firm, and the other was Koop Blankstein. Both started in the early 50s, Waisman-Ross a little ahead of Izzy Koop and Morley Blankstein. And their roots, I believe, for both Waisman on the Waisman-Ross side and for Koop and Blankstein are rooted in the Chicago School of Architecture, which they attended to do their master's degrees and studied under Mies van der Rohe. So very influenced by the modernist definition of architecture of the day, but an architecture and expression related to clarity of structure and planning organization. It's very prominent in the work of both of those practices in the 50s. And then the other founding members of the Koop Blankstein group would be Al Hanna and Doug Gilmore. Doug Gilmore was a professor of architecture at the University of Manitoba, teaching design, and both he and Al Hanna went to the MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, which had a different strain of approaches to design and problem solving and understanding of buildings. But they both came together. Both firms were growing and decided to amalgamate in 1964, which became ultimately Number 10 Architectural Group. They amalgamated in a building that Waisman-Ross developed at Number 10 Donald Street. As the firm grew and grew in partners, they very quickly became the architects at Number 10 Donald Street or Number 10 Architectural Group. So their roots go into both the Miesian theme, particularly related to Morley Blankstein and Izzy Koop and Al Waisman's work, and the MIT school had influences on how they approached design.
A lot of their buildings do have that, and there's still the innovation and sustainability are at the core of your firm's designs. And you led many of such projects, still considered to be some of the best ever produced by the firm. Which would you say might be one of the most memorable for you?
There are a number over the years, but I think the most memorable is the Oak Hammock Center. That is built onto the restored Oak Hammock Marsh, and they were seeking to develop a center for education related to marsh environment. As we're aware today, there's very great significance on the environment. And it was a collaboration between Ducks Unlimited Canada and Natural Resources Manitoba to create both a conservation center and the headquarters for Ducks Unlimited Canada. So that was a project that had an invited design competition in this region, and Number 10 won it in about 1989, and we were awarded the contract in 1990. But the project is very significant to me because a core part of our practice is collaboration with all of our clients and engineering associates and other practices. And the Oak Hammock Center was a phenomenal collaboration between our design team, the landscape architects, Gary Hilderman, the engineering consultants related to water treatment, and a whole range of avian and marsh specialists with Ducks Unlimited Canada. So it resulted in quite a phenomenal building for its day. I think it would have been a LEED Gold building if that was in place at the time, because in every way we had to understand both the environment, how we treated and gathered water, how we dealt with the marsh edge, how we created a building with low impact relative to bird migration. So it was quite a phenomenal opportunity to have integration of almost every aspect of the issue of design and site. And what has evolved out of it almost 30 years ago that developed the design is a building that I'm still proud to say you go to and stand on the green roof, lose the perspective that you're actually on a building and overlook this marsh during the migration period and have had no interruption to any of the bird migration. So that building stands out for me, in particular the collaboration of many people brought together with our design team with a very strong concept to develop a building at a marsh edge that had very low impact, both environmentally and energy-wise.
Certainly the collaboration is an important aspect. So when you start the process and you incorporate a particular concept, what process does a team go through?
It very much varies with the project scale, complexity, and client, and also on the project, you know, delivery process, how the team is structured and who are all partners of the team. I think that our approach to collaborative design allowed us to be very open to many different ways to deliver projects, like working with contractors very early in the process in design build, delivery, or construction management, because we learned early on that everyone contributes to what the best solution is and best approaches to solutions. So if I take, for example, the new convention center expansion, we had a team that was broad-ranging geographically. We had the two very good practices in Winnipeg, Number 10 Architectural Group and LM Architectural Group, and an extraordinary practice in Seattle, Washington, LMN Group. And we had engineering groups from Seattle, Los Angeles, Houston, Vancouver, Toronto, and Winnipeg engaged. So we early on developed a process where everyone was engaged at the table, bringing to it all of their core issues on best approaches from a planning, structural, and system integration point of view, as well as working with the client to understand how that all meshes to deliver the optimal convention space and convention experience. So you really, the approach to design are finding ways to have that large team collaboratively work together and communicate. The notions of projects being developed by individual people or small groups is kind of moved on. It's very much a process of being able to work with and manage these large teams with the client and ensure that everyone is communicating the best options that can be brought to the table to deliver the best building.
And did that experience and collaboration working with so many different groups of people, has that led to your involvement in a number of innovative international projects as well as the local ones that you might be able to tell us about where they're located?
Over the years, the firm has been involved in projects in India, the Canadian Embassy in Pakistan, with a university in Africa, in Zambia, a university actually that Morley Blankstein's son recently visited and we got some update photos on, and it's a university that was finished in 1973-74, is still functioning very well. But more recently, I think that what that idea of collaboration has led to is the firm is now a leader in the delivery of 21st century education facilities and practices. And that grew out of a collaboration between Number 10 and the education studio leads, Greg Hasiuk and Doug Hanna, with a U.S. firm who were leaders in education facility innovation. So that now the firm is a leader in that dialogue on education design and leading a number of major new schools in Saskatchewan and Alberta. And it grew out of being open to that dialogue with other designers and other firms to learn, to expand on ideas, and working very closely with client groups to listen to what their needs are and understanding how those things can be brought together. I believe the collaboration roots are critical to how our practice has evolved and how we continue to kind of move ahead and learn from every project.
So in furthering that expansion of ideas and learning, Number 10 is also at the cutting edge of the industry's latest BIM technology and one of the first to practice in Manitoba with a 3D printer. Your teams are capable of producing those BIM documents. Can you tell us how this new technology contributes to architecture?
Building Information Modeling, or BIM, is really an outgrowth of programs like Revit, which are three-dimensional modeling programs, which are the outgrowth of the original CAD, or computer-aided drafting programs, or drawing programs. Revit really is the platform that the practice works in. So everything is produced on a three-dimensional basis. What that allows is an integration of all the elements of the building, because they all have to be located three-dimensionally in space in a document. And what it has led to is the need for the absolute critical nature of the collaboration between all of the design team and engineering team to have a set of documents that actually integrate all the building systems. So on the technology level, you have a complete integration of systems, and it's a platform for delivering projects, which allowed us to deliver very large public projects and very difficult projects like the Convention Center expansion within a very, very tight time frame and fast track delivery. So it allows you on the one side to do that, but on the other, the Revit programs are supplemented by rendering and three-dimensional modeling programs that allow you to walk through buildings, virtual reality tours of buildings, very quick in the design development process, very quick sketch rendered three-dimensional images of spaces, and in fact, virtual reality walkthrough of wireframe spaces. So they're tremendous vehicles for guiding client groups through the development of the design and helping them to understand how the project is evolving and what the spaces yield for them, even beyond just the program of space needs. It's a phenomenal tool that we try to make the most of. And in fact, we've found recently some of the three-dimensional modeling programs that we've been using, in fact, weren't being used by some of the leading Toronto firms and ones we're collaborating with, and they're now using them to help illustrate their projects to clients early on. So it's a real commitment to investing in technology and in particular training in order to stay ahead of the curve on project development and design.
It's really fascinating. And it gives many people opportunities to bring different skill sets to the architectural field.
I think there is that opportunity. Architecture skills are broad ranging, and there are people who work in many different areas of the industry. But the Revit model brings together everyone in terms of project managers, technologists, interior designers, the design leads, the client collaboration, or the collaborators and project leaders, into a model into which they can all contribute elements on an ongoing live platform, but then they can also huddle around that platform and travel through it three-dimensionally to see impacts of change or design approaches very quickly.
Well, I'd like to thank you very much for taking the time to share your insight with us tonight. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you. That was Robert Eastwood, Senior Advisor at No. 10 Architectural Group here in Winnipeg. I'm your host, Susan Cohn, and we thank you for listening to Art World Innovators here on UMFM 101.5 at the University of Manitoba. Join us again next Wednesday from 5:30 to 6 p.m. for more on today's innovators in the art world.